Good morning. I feel like I should introduce myself again. You wouldn't think that that your life would be so hard to get back together when you've only been gone a week, but we had a good time in Oregon. We got 300 and some new cases and finished the data collection on a three-year project, so we're feeling pretty good about that. It's one of the costs that you pay for coming to college at a place like this, and actually I'm going to talk about that in this lecture. There is a payoff, and well, part of it, I guess, the payoff was 5 free points on the test, and the other part is getting to look at some of the stuff that we're doing that really nobody else has. It's good to be back, and I'm going to take things just a little bit out of order today. We have three topics in this segment. It's very similar to the last one. We are going to take in turn the last three social institutions, what I call the value-based social institutions, education, family, and religion. And we're going to use, we're going to go with education first today. I know family is first on the syllabus, but there's some things I want to adapt for family and religion, and I haven't had a chance to do that. I've literally been in town for 14 or 15 hours after having been away for 9 days, so it's a little bit flaky getting things back together. So the education piece is today. We'll do family on Thursday and religion on Tuesday, and then a week from Thursday is the fifth, and for some of you maybe the last exam you'll need to take, hopefully, that you know, you'll have gotten the grade that you can get, and you'll be happy. Now, we will continue to take attendance for the last segment of the class. So the question, do I have to come to class after you take the fifth test if you're happy with your test scores? The answer is you never have to come to class. It's a free country. And so the question I would ask in answer to that question is, how much do you wish to learn? And the last segment's the coolest one of the bunch. It really is. So anyway, that's the drill. We have these last three social institutions this week and next. Test a week from Thursday, a review a week from Wednesday, as typical, and that will take place in the English Philosophy Building as it has been. So again, are there any lingering questions to this point? Yeah, I was away without my laptop. I had so much crap I had to take with me that I only took an iPad to respond to only the most urgent emails, and I have to update the website with my laptop, and I just have it with me. So I will do that later today. I didn't get a chance in the last hour. I did update the web page for handouts. The handouts and the study guide are now for this segment at the top of the page, but that's the best I could do. I'm sorry about that. You know, we've been spot on the last four times, so I just appreciate your patience on that. I appreciate your patience on having to listen to the audio on the economy. How many of you said that that at least tolerably worked? Okay. I know it was an old lecture and there were some things that were maybe a little confusing in it. As it turns out, you're the last group that has to put up with that. People have been doing this in my class now for 3 years and you're it. That was the last time. So I tried to pay you back with 5 questions on the test, and we'll just move forward. Other questions? All right, let me blow through this stuff. I've got to get that off of there. Remind me never to update this computer. Okay. We'll blow through these definitions, terms, and concepts, and at the end of this presentation today is a video of 15 minutes in length that illustrates what Jonathan Kozol, the author of the book on which this video was based, calls savage inequalities, public education in America's schools. There will also be a Windows and Apple version of that 15-minute video posted on the website later today. And so that will also be available. Okay, we have terms and concepts, comparative perspectives, and a video today. Education actually, in general, means more than just schooling, because we're learning all the time. I learned a whole lot about Reed College students that I had no idea. They're very, very different and very unique. They generally come from elite prep schools in the Northeast. And let me just illustrate the difference. One of the professors at Oregon State, when I was telling him about having been to Reed College, which is a very prestigious school in the Northeast, and looked at the questions we were asking about drinking and drugging and so on, he said, "You should have asked the Reed students, are you currently under the influence of an illegal drug?" And he said, "You would have gotten more yeses than you think, as it were." So you're learning stuff all the time. I learned that the state of Oregon is the polar opposite of West Texas. Oregon is green and cold and wet. And West Texas is hot and brown and dry. And I'll tell you what, I like it here a lot better. I think that Portland, Oregon must be the seasonal affective disorder capital of the world. Gray just settles in. So we're learning all the time. But for our purposes today, let's talk about education and schooling as a formal process. And this is the definition, a formal process in which some persons consciously teach, and others adopt the role of learner. That's you. You're adopting the role of learner right now. I am making every effort to consciously teach. Although I will tell you, and maybe you've had professors of this type, they actually look like they're sort of unconscious up there. I mean, their mouths are moving and noise is coming out, but nothing's upstairs. And I'm going to try to avoid adding to that with my work here. It's a formal process of learning in which some persons, I mean, it's essentially an exchange of role expectations. The professor professes something. The students write it down, hopefully think about it and learn something as a result. A couple of terms that characterize public education in American schools. Credentialism is the process, it is the requirement that a person hold an advanced degree as a condition of employment. The requirement that a person hold an advanced degree as a condition of employment. All of you are in a race right now for a credential. They hang the bachelor's degrees right up about here. You got to kind of make your way to the wall and then kind of get on your tiptoes and maybe jump a little bit. And you get that credential. And you then can sell the fact that you've been through it. Sure, it wasn't too confusing, was it? It's the requirement that a person hold an advanced degree as a condition of employment. I remember my first job as a college graduate. I was a program director in a YMCA. I ran the swim team and all that. I think I mentioned that to you before. Almost nothing I learned in college had a direct application to what I did on that job, except I learned diligence. I learned to keep my promises. I learned that that people are interesting and entertaining, but very little of what I learned in the classroom, in the sense that engineering students learn things in classrooms and they're applied to things that they encounter on their first day on the job. But the point is, I needed to have that degree before they would allow me to apply. And employers use this as a kind of screening tool. They only want people who have demonstrated they can succeed in this. So the odds are raised, they believe, that they'll succeed when they hire you. So these credentials, these college degrees, high school diplomas, advanced degrees, and so on, these are tokens that you earn essentially by jumping through hoops. A college graduate can say, especially a college graduate with a high grade point, "I have learned to work hard and follow instructions." And most employers would say those are the two things I most want in an entry-level employee. Someone will work hard and do what they're told. Mainstreaming is the process of integrating quote-unquote handicapped kids into quote-unquote regular classrooms. Maybe you've encountered this in public education in your own life. Students with special needs are mainstreamed into some parts of the curriculum and are put into special areas for others, art and music maybe, as opposed to reading and math. And perhaps some of you have high school graduate colleagues that are developmentally disabled in some way and earn a high school degree in a different way. But they earn the degree and they earn the diploma and they walk across the stage. They've been mainstreamed through the process. And most social psychologists would say this is a useful thing. I'm using these definitions to kind of set the backdrop for other things we're going to talk about. So the definitions may seem disconnected, but they do tie together under the umbrella of this presentation. Minimum competency tests are standardized tests which measure basic skills. What do they call it now? STARS or something like that? Used to be TOCS, then it was TOS, all of which are synonyms for
Texas something.
No, yeah, I know. I was trying to think of something that described my feeling for what the synonym is without using profanity. Never mind. I liked TOCS better because I do think, in my opinion, standardized tests are toxic. And my job is to detoxify you. So let's pretend that's what they still are. They measure basic skills. They also tend to gravitate folks toward the mean. And we talked about special ed a minute ago. Those folks sort of at the low end of standardized testing competency, they're in special ed. They get exemptions in many regards from standardized tests. Teachers get more credit for taking someone from 68 to 72 than they get from taking someone to 80 to 95. And the people over here at the high end, I believe, are in some sense special ed students in different ways, but no less dramatic in many regards. Okay, tracking involves placing students in curriculum groups based on these test scores. Everybody knows what the high, middle, and low reading group is. I missed that. What was that? Oh, come on. Somebody tell me what happened.
Huh?
Someone hit their what?
Siri
just joined the building? Siri had fun? Okay.
But she didn't hear you, so she said I didn't quite get that.
Oh, Siri didn't quite get it? Siri, minimum competency test, our toxic. Did she get that? I have no idea where I was. That was pretty funny. I've never had Siri join the class before. Okay, social promotion is kind of a controversial issue. It involves passing kids from one grade to the next based on age rather than test scores. And this is sort of controversial, you know. There is a mindset in American politics that would say, you know what, let's leave no kid behind and let's make sure that they pass the test even if they have to become felons. I give you the Atlanta public school system at the moment that basically the Atlanta public schools administration is being turned inside out for a massive cheating scandal on standardized tests. Or we have to bring kids forward who don't pass the tests because in some instances, it's dangerous to have someone who is of sixth grade age in a third or fourth grade classroom. And the notion of retaining a student from one grade to the same grade is a little bit controversial. My wife is an elementary school guidance counselor by profession, and in her profession, folks know that when a child is retained from, let's say, second grade to second grade, they do very well their second time around in second grade. But unless something very different happens in how they're taught, because they generally have special needs, and as you'll see in a little while, it's expensive, and we choose often as not to spend money in this way, the next year they're kind of back where they were. So how long can you keep, quote-unquote, flunking a kid until you have what can be a socially dangerous situation, someone who is beyond you know, what would be appropriate in terms of physical development in a classroom full of literally small children, relatively speaking. So these are just the terms that we'll use to kind of set the backdrop. You want me to redefine any of this stuff? Yeah. Tracking involves placing students in curriculum groups based on test scores. We have the apple, orange, and banana reading group or some such thing. Anything else? Okay. From a functionalist point of view, how does education in America, how does public education maintain, preserve, enhance social stability? Well, it transmits culture, for one thing. We not only learn reading, writing, and arithmetic, and I've always been puzzled by that, you know, the old notion of, yeah, let's just go back to the basics, let's teach them the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Two of those three don't start with the letter R. So if we're teaching students the three R's and call them that, we're teaching them wrong with a W. Or maybe with an R, I don't know. We transmit culture. We learn not only concepts and facts. We learn gender roles. Sometimes we learn religious values, even in public schools. Sometimes we learn that religious values are contested, even in public schools. But what's important to our culture, like the English language, among other things, is transmitted through the public education system. We also integrate. Public education is often the focal point for the assimilation of immigrants, for bringing new folks into the culture and making Americans out of them, in a sense, by formalizing how the English language is learned. And public education children sometimes teach their parents and grandparents the language of the new culture. So there's an integrative function to public education. Immigrants are socialized into a new culture. There's also an integrative function to the collective identity that comes out of public education. You know, think of your school mascots and the main rivalry town or team in your high school life. I don't know why the University of Oregon calls itself the Ducks. You know, and when they play the Cougars or the Panthers or the Red Raiders, what do? They duck. I don't know. Social placement. We do this to some degree with standardized tests. We place people in curriculum groups. There are experiments that are, from time to time, tried in America that try to imitate the German public school system, which is very rigidly tracked. At about middle school age, everyone is given a test in Germany, and they are tracked into one of four secondary educational processes, only one of which is college prep. It's called Gymnasium, and arguably, it's sort of like an honors program. Students in Germany that come through the gymnasium track are probably at high school graduation, or at what we would call that, gymnasium graduation. They're probably as highly educated as a college sophomore in the U.S. But there are other tracks toward trade school and skilled labor, toward office level middle management, and special ed. And once in Germany you get on that track, it's very hard to get off. So there's a placement process that standardized testing facilitates to some degree in the U.S., but they don't go nearly as far as the German public school system. And you can Google that and look it up. And you know, you might want to just write yourself a note. Check out German public education by comparison on the topic of social placement. Schools also, public education also functions as a social control mechanism, a couple of different ways. One, just learning habits like putting your head down until the bell rings, or, you know, moving in prescribed ways at prescribed intervals. I went to the University of Wisconsin, which at the time was one of the most quote-unquote liberal, progressive, anti-war, etc., etc. Everything you could think of that's quasi-communist would characterize the University of Wisconsin in the 60s and 70s when I went there. And when class was over, the bell still rang, which was kind of interesting. Now, I don't think a lot of people paid attention to it, but there were bells in college that signaled the end of the class period. There are other issues related to social control in public ed, the regulation of conduct, truancy, all of these sorts of things. Things you can get punished or even spanked for, I guess, in some schools, right? Can you still get spanked in Texas? Is it a graduation requirement that you have to be spanked at least once in Texas? I don't know. But went to a school where they could whack your little fanny if you did something wrong. You had to have permission on file, right? And there had to be a witness. I don't know. There's something about this that vaguely creeps me out. You know, some middle-aged, geezed-up principal with a paddle spanking, you know, a 12-year-old or something. But in any case, social control involves learning what the rules are and being coerced into keeping them. And public ed does some of that, not just within school, but also as a kind of rehearsal for the rest of our lives. Social change. A great deal of social change has occurred through public education, like Brown versus Board of Education. Certainly the civil rights movement was practiced and negotiated and fought over in public schools. And even now, you know, the role of religion in public education is changing. How many of you graduated from a high school, a public high school, at which the ceremony involved a prayer? And the ceremony's prayer was even explicitly Christian, in Jesus' name or something to that effect, a public school. Do you have any notion that that's a federal crime? And nobody said anything? In fact, they would fight to preserve it in some ways. The whole relationship between church and state is sometimes negotiated and even contested as public education becomes a forum for social change. And there are other ways in which that's the case as well. And finally, cultural innovation. Once again, there are a million ways of illustrating any of these concepts, and I'm kind of going all over the map and illustrating them in different ways. This particular concept I want to relate to the benefit you get for attending a public research-oriented university. One of the most interesting days of my college career, one of the few that I vividly remember, involved a chemistry class I was taking when I thought I wanted to be when I thought I was pre-med. The professor was a wonderful prof. He even actually wrote me a letter of recommendation for seminary after I got a C in his class, which was amazing. One of the best chemistry professors on our campus and maybe the best ever, walked into class and said, "We're not going to talk about the oxidation reduction equation or whatever the heck we were supposed to talk about that day." He said, "I just got a phone call from my pal Howie." And I've mentioned this name to you before. His pal Howie was Dr. Howard Thiemann, who taught at the medical school at the University of Wisconsin in 1974 and 1975. And my chemistry prof and he were friends, and Howie called my prof and said, "I just got a call from Stockholm. I share the Nobel Prize this year." I go, "Man, is that cool or what? Somebody from my school just won the Nobel Prize for medicine." This was Dr. Thiemann, whose work in retroviruses has told us, even still, as much as we know now about lung cancer and other forms. And the great irony is that Howard Thiemann, one of America's leading anti-smoking advocates, wound up dying relatively early in life. I think he was in his early 60s, if that, from lung cancer, which is bizarre. But anyway, that day, instead of chemistry, we talked about my prof's pal's Howie's research. and how retroviruses and the use of spectroscopy and all manners of interesting things led to his being awarded the Nobel Prize. Now, in this segment of this course, a week from today, I'm going to show you some of the stuff that we've been doing over the last 3 years as we have been seeking the moral community. Nobody else in the world has those data, and none of it will even be made public until November, when I go to a conference and show them the stuff that that I'm working on now. I don't know whether you consider that a benefit or not, but at least you get to learn stuff that's on the cutting edge of what at least one researcher cares about. You decide. I'm not going to get a call from Stockholm on this, not ever. But I think it's interesting enough to show you a little bit about comparing college students' attitudes and experiences about a variety of different things. And in at least one instance, my colleagues at Baylor think I've got something that is extremely valuable to people who are administrators at Christian schools. So who knows? Anyway, I'll show you a little of that. And that's just something you get in exchange for coming to a place where professors are evaluated for three things: research, teaching, and service, but research is first among equals. If you find classes of 200 people off-putting, if you don't like it when professors essentially send you the message that college students in Oregon are more important than you for a week, which is sort of the message you couldn't get from last week, well, then you go somewhere else. You go to a smaller place. And you get a different kind of educational experience. But at least theoretically, the people who do what I do, some to a greater or lesser degree, are on the cutting edge of innovation. We research questions that maybe even change the world a little bit. Researchers at Texas Tech University 10 or 15 years ago in the physics department discovered what's known in the literature as the top quark, Q-U-A-R-K, which, if nothing else, is a great word if you're playing words with friends. If you can play Q-U-A-R-K on a triple, you'll get a lot of points. A quark is a subatomic particle. We discovered the top one, you know, whatever that is. I don't even know what it is. Google that, and you'll be smarter than me. And I don't know whether that's Nobel Prize winning or caliber research, but it's close in that regard. So that's part of the benefit of the way we construct public higher education as well as public secondary education. All right, from a functionalist point of view then, all of these components of or features of public education help keep the wheels on. Fair enough? Questions? All right, let's move to the other side of the room for a minute and talk about, from a conflict point of view, how public education reproduces social inequality. It promotes assimilation. And once again, standardized testing is in the middle of this, gravitating everybody toward the mean, making English the official language. It dilutes diversity, arguably. It promotes assimilation and thereby dilutes diversity. Secondly, credentials are a scarce resource. From a conflict point of view, it is a myth. It is a myth that, I'm going to put the credentials on that wall because I'm going to stay on this side of the room. It is a myth that everybody lines up on a starting line at kindergarten and runs on a level playing field to the place where they stand on tiptoes for college degrees and jump a little bit for graduate degrees and so on. From a conflict point of view, in the film I'm going to show you in 30 minutes or less, will illustrate how public students do not start on a starting line. They start on a grid. The metaphor I often use for this is the Boston Marathon. Not everybody can run in the Boston Marathon. You have to qualify for that. So it's an elite race to begin with. You have to be able to demonstrate that you can run 26 miles in change in, I believe, something around four and a half hours. That's not easy to do. And several thousand people do that every year. And the line, the starting line in Hopkinton, Massachusetts, and the race runs from Hopkinton to Boston, isn't long enough to put 1,000 people on, you know, at the same point. So they start in a grid. And what's I think metaphorically illustrative about this is the people that get to start on the front of that pack are the world's most elite runners. In other words, the most elite get the first place. I think they should reverse that. I think they should put the Olympic gold medal marathon winner at the back of the pack, because that would make it more fair, but it isn't. Well, from a conflict point of view, that's sort of how public education reproduces social inequality, because schools are not all created equal. And where you landed, how well you picked your parents even, especially with regard to the ability to get a private school education in an elite environment in the Northeast, etc., simply reproduces the level of inequality or the gap between haves and have-nots. So imagine here, under this topic, credentials as a scarce resource, imagine metaphorically the starting grid for the Boston Marathon. And arguably, that's how public schools stratify or reproduce inequality for America's public school children. And the video will illustrate that in a more powerful way. Bestows status selectively. Tracking is based on results of standardized tests. Standardized tests may not measure. In fact, there's a great body of research that conflict theorists point to that say, in fact, standardized tests do not measure what they intend to measure, that is, the probability of success or intellectual capacity. Rather, from a conflict point of view, they measure things like conformity, being able to demonstrate you can color within the lines. And once again, maybe even obliterates from this point of view the possibility for creative thinking. Let me illustrate. The last time I had a major research grant was now, 7 or 8 years ago. And I had, in that grant, I was able to hire a research assistant, an African-American woman who was actually a little older than most and had a child, was in our graduate program and earned with us a master's degree. And then once she was done doing the work that she did with me and others in our department, she went on to be accepted in and is now a doctoral candidate at the University of Washington, which is a top 10 sociology department. It's one of the 10 best, highly regarded sociology graduate programs in the country. And my research assistant, who got a master's with us, went on to be accepted into and funded by and is now writing a dissertation to become a PhD sociologist at one of the best programs in the country. This person, and she thinks it had a lot to do with the fact that she was a black female and still is, this person was tracked into the low reading group as a public school student in a poor school district. And she illustrated, it's kind of in microcosm, an illustration of how things like standardized tests cannot standardize people. And she was regarded by her teachers as a slow learner. Well, I hope when she gets her doctorate, she scans and emails to all those folks and asks that when they send information to her, if they ever do, they refer to her as Dr. Slow Learner, etc. So the things we use to identify people that become not only labels but a way of life in public education, reproduce inequality, and even make mistakes in ways that can be profoundly consequential. This leads to the interactionist insight here that applies labeling theory to public education. One of the most interesting, and this is on your reading assignment list, one of the most interesting pieces of educational social research was done in the 60s by a pair of educational psychologists whose last names are Rist, R-I-S-T, and Rosenthal. The Rist and Rosenthal experiments illustrate labeling theory, which is a kind of micro-level symbolic interactionist insight that talks about the effect of being told what you are and how you live up or down to those expectations. Rist and Rosenthal swooped into public schools all across America and told teachers and administrators that they had invented an interesting survey tool. It was, in effect, a standardized test. And they said, just as third and fourth graders go through physical growth spurts, and you may remember going through one of those where you get a brand new outfit and like a month later it doesn't fit anymore because you've grown very quickly. The human body goes through growth spurts. Well, Rist and Rosenthal made the argument that the human mind does the same thing. And they told public school teachers and administrators that they had invented a test that could predict which of these public education students were on the edge of an intellectual growth spurt. These are the kids who are just about to take off. And so they administered the test in public schools all over the place, and as a result gave a list of names back to teachers and administrators. 20% of the people that took the test made it onto that list. And they were told, the teachers and administrators were told, that here's a list of your students that are on the edge of an intellectual growth spurt. And by golly, they came back and retested them at the end of the year, and those 20% did measurably and markedly better, both on the standardized tests and on every measure of performance in the public school. They got higher grades, they were rewarded for being smarter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These 20% that were on the edge of an intellectual growth spurt according to the test that they were given did better. Well, here's the trick in this study. That list of 20%, the names that were on that list and given to teachers and administrators, were chosen completely and totally at random. They randomly picked 20%, handed the list to teachers, and said, these are the kids that are about to take off intellectually, and by gosh, they did. More broadly based, this concept is called a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you tell somebody long enough and often enough that they're a star, that they've got potential, and that you want to help them develop that potential, there's a pretty good chance they will. If you tell a kid often enough and loud enough that they really don't have much to offer, and they might be better off learning at best a skilled trade, and this is what the Germans do, well, they tend to live up or down to that. The Rist and Rosenthal experiments are some of the most well-known examples of how you can create identity, how you can negotiate and even enforce a kind of educational identity. And my former graduate student, now doctoral candidate, is an example of someone who was told, you know, that you're probably not going to amount to much, so, you know, do the best you can and we'll sort of talk at the end of the year, that sort of thing. Well, you know, she showed him. But there's a lot of people that never do. And I find this both intriguing and horrifying in some respects. The self-fulfilling prophecy and expectations of school administrators when their students are given labels illustrate on a micro level how powerful words can be. Questions so far? Okay, this is the end of the talking part of this presentation, so I'm just going to shut the recorder off because I will also post, in addition to this recording, an Apple file and a Windows file of some kind of the 15-minute video that I'm about to show you. Fair enough?